Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
It's time for Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode number 72 for June 4th, 2010. The Magic Cauliflower is back. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by the new Carbonite Pro. It's simple, secure, and affordable online backup for your small business. For a free trial and to learn more, visit CarbonitePro.com. And by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/Twitch. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Ryan Shrout, and we have Patrick Norton with us as always. How are you doing, Patrick?
Good, man. And yourself?
I'm tired. I'm still waking up. It's early here in Taiwan. It's just about 9:30 or so. But we have a special guest. I don't know if a lot of our audience will know who he is, but he's got some expertise in the field. He's been around for a while.
I just have a microphone, and I'm not afraid to use it.
Leo sitting in with us today.
Hey, Ryan. Hey, Patrick.
Hi, Leo.
I'm so excited. So, Ryan, you're in Taiwan right now.
Yes.
Looks fantastic. I mean, what a good picture and everything. No latency.
Yeah. When everybody checks out of the hotel and you have the internet to yourself, sometimes it'll actually work. I had less trouble this year than I've had in the past at the Hyatt down in downtown Taipei. Usually, I always complain about how high-tech the city is and all the stuff that is built here. And you can't find reliable internet connection, but they seem to have done pretty well this time. So we went through the whole show yesterday without any disconnections.
Is it your experience that the bandwidth is better in Taiwan? I know in Japan it's better, right?
It is not better here. I was in Japan. I went to Japan a few days before I came here. Actually, I'd never been to Tokyo. And I went there, and in my hotel, I was getting like 12 megs down and 10 megs up or something like that.
Oh, man.
So that was nice. Here, not so much. Maybe, you know, two down, one up type of thing, but more than enough to do this. So
how's it been at Computex?
It's been pretty good. It's been fairly busy. There are a lot of announcements we were talking about before the show, where Steve said something about 45 tablet announcements. That's obviously
Steve Gibson, not Steve Jobs, by the way.
Feature the killer product to be discussing at the show. Everybody,
is everybody doing an iPad clone? Just look at that. As soon as we said how good the service was, boom. Boom. Yeah, Steve Gibson, I was asking Steve Gibson, he's watching Computex, and he said that the huge number of pad announcements, slate announcements, and he and I kind of agree that while the iPad is an iPad, are you an iPad user, Patrick?
The person whom you're trying to reach is currently unavailable.
What a surprise. That doesn't surprise me.
I am an iPad. I own an iPad. I'm happy.
I'm so surprised to hear you say that. So you like it?
Yeah, it's you know, I paid too much for it. It's a toy, but it's a phenomenal. You know, Seamus loves using it. He can interact with it. I watch movies on it, and with a couple of tweaks, I'm actually getting to the point where I can run all of the Revision 3 software I need. The software we use at Revision 3 to produce Texilla and Xination.
This is the software you need. We rule, my friend. You need a farm.
Isn't that the game that Veronica keeps playing on her iPad and then screaming when it stops running in the middle of some important corn transit?
Yes. Nothing worse than trying to harvest your corn when the internet or the servers, the Plus servers are terrible.
I just say that was about the most ironic thing to happen to me in a long
time. Isn't that funny? Losing your connection, Ryan's back. As soon as he says how good it is, he's frozen solid.
Yeah. But I guess let's go ahead and jump into some of the hardware news over the past couple of weeks, because I think we missed a week last week due to some other traveling. I think I was on my way to Japan when all that happened.
In flight. What's the story with the Core i7 875K and the Core i5 655K, and what exactly are they talking about unlocked on those?
An unlocked processor refers to the multipliers that you can adjust for overclocking.
So it's clock locking we're talking about.
Right.
Yeah. So usually what you cannot do on a retail processor is increase the multiplier on a CPU. So if the base speed is 133 megahertz as it is on the Core i5 and i7 parts, then they apply a multiplier to it like 20, and all of a sudden you're running at 2.6 gigahertz. What you used to be able to do for overclocking is you'd be able to increase that front side bus, or not the front side bus, but the bus speed, lower the mm-hmm. multipliers in order to get higher total clock speeds. With the K-series that Intel's introduced with these two parts, they are unlocked from the factory, which means you can actually increase the multipliers up.
Is that because they want to curry favor with the overclockers? Are there even any overclockers left?
That's the only reason to do this. That's the only reason to make these parts and to sell.
How funny.
Is to,
can they charge more for it?
They charge a little bit more, but what's interesting is Intel's had an unlocked processor for a long time, but it's always been the Extreme Edition,
right.
$1,000 plus part. Right, and so these sell for, I think the 655K is like $220, and the 875K will be like $340. So these are much lower price for unlocked parts, and this is what the extreme, you know, those extreme overclockers, those people that want to do heavy overclocking are obviously going to want these parts. To me, what I found was I had a lot of good results overclocking the 655K. I think I got it up to 4.8 gigahertz.
Pretty water cooling or air cooling?
Air cooling with like a Thermaltake Orb air cooler, mm-hmm. you know, a $40 or $50 air cooler. And I didn't have to, you know, push voltages. I think it pushed it to like 1.45, which is high, but not super high.
Mm-hmm.
And all this was done using the turbo mode multipliers. So turbo mode is the feature that Intel's processors will kind of automatically overclock when based on workload and that kind of thing. So the benefit of that was it was only running at 4.8 gigahertz when I was actually doing something. When the computer was idle, it was running at
back down
1.2 gigahertz, you know, the dialed down speed. So you didn't get constant power consumption issues. But if I was, you know, when we ran our encoding tests for, you know, video transcoding tests, mm-hmm. it went up to 4.8 gigahertz, ran through everything real nice and fast, and then slowed back down. Whereas usually when you'd overclock before, if you overclocked to 4.5 gigahertz, it was there the whole time. So your system was constantly running at that overheated, overvoltaged state. Whereas with these, you don't have to do that.
You mentioned the 655K, which is Core i5 part, being particularly mm-hmm. overclocking friendly. What about the 875K, the Core i7 part? Was it, you know, happier than the 920 to overclock, or...
I felt it was I wasn't as impressed with that one. I kind of thought it was the same. I got 4.3 gigahertz out of it, but you got to remember the Core i7 part is a quad core hyper threaded part. The Core i5 655K is a dual core hyper threaded part. So there's a little bit, and it's also a 32 nanometer processor as opposed to 45 nanometer processor. So they're fairly different chips as far as the architecture and the design and the process technology goes. So it didn't really surprise me that the dual core went further. You know, I mean, it has half as many cores, a lot less heat to deal with and that kind of stuff, and on a better process tech. So, but I mean, overall for $215, it's a great processor if you're willing to, you know, do the overclocking for it. Right. If you're not going to overclock, don't spend the extra money. But I mean, you're talking maybe a $30 price premium over like the standard CPU of a similar performance level at its base frequencies. So,
Is this Intel trying to just beat on AMD and the Phenom processor, or is it just some corner of the market that felt they didn't have a good part for?
So the Phenom's a real overclockable part, is that?
Yeah.
The AMD has these Black Edition processors that they've been marketing for like 2 years, and Black Edition processors are unlocked. And you can get pretty cheap unlocked parts. And so a lot of these extreme overclockers that are just trying to get world records and this type of stuff, or just set, you know, frequency highs and that kind of thing, they were using these AMD parts because they were unlocked, and they could, you know, if they burned one up, caught one on fire, whatever you want to do, it didn't cost them a lot of money, right? It was $100, $150 you can get some of those unlocked AMD parts for. So Intel, I think, definitely felt like it's not going to cost them any more money really to do this. It's not a huge market that's doing this.
But it's nice to have the world's fastest processor, or make themselves a little more likely.
That's got to be it, right? It can't be a very big market. How many overclockers could there possibly be? But right. but you get attention when you say, oh, look, the Intel Extreme was able to go to 4.58 gigahertz. that's good PR, right? I mean, what else could they, what other reason could they?
I mean, it really, it's probably, you're right, because a lot of the highest overclocked existing parts are AMD parts right now.
Right. That's got to, that's got to hurt them.
You know, so they dominate in every other market and field, really. And so they're like, well, all right, let's take a little bit of this too. So, but hey, for a normal consumer, if even if you're not the extreme overclocker, it's just nice to have more options that way. So
I guess. I guess.
Some of us still overclock, Leo.
Really? Yes. It just seems so, I don't know, screensavers.
I overclocked my Palm Pre, so, you know.
Well, no, I did. Yeah, people overclock their phones. I know that. And of course, if you want bad battery life, that's a great way to kill your battery. But
so say, are you saying I'm 20th century, not 21st
yeah,
century?
Yeah, it just seems like it's, I mean, it's like, why? It's all about, it's like souping up a car now, right? I mean, it's all.
I heard a good analogy like that. It was like taking the engine out of your car and seeing how high you can tack it.
Right. It's a very niche audience. Used to be you do it because you want to stick it to the man. You know, you get a you get a 600 megahertz processor and get it to 750 with like those old Celerons. But
that's right.
But come on. Nobody nowadays, you're buying a 2.66 gigahertz part. You don't need to overclock it.
Absolutely. If you want, you know what, the more video you render and the more disks you encode, the more you want a faster CPU. I bought a 920. I overclocked it faster. I bought a $250, $300 part, overclocked it till it was running faster than the $1,000 part. That made me happy.
Yeah, but I'm telling you,
sticking it to the man.
You're sticking it to the man because
I haven't sold out like you.
What does it do for reliability? What does it do for the light?
It's amazing. If you put a decent, even air coolers now, a $50 air cooler. There's some just fantastic air coolers now. If you're water cooling, it's almost impossible to overheat the thing.
All right, maybe there is a.
I mean, do you even still own a PC, Leo?
Like a desktop? No, I actually don't. I mean, I mean, technically, we have PCs all over the place. But
have
I mean,
you, have you
like
personally...
one I use? No, I use laptops. Yeah, I use laptops. So you're right.
Mm.
You're right.
You know. You're ripping through 400 Blu-rays to install them on your home server.
But we, you know, I don't think we do all our rendering with Macs, of course. But I mean, we just buy faster Macs.
Right.
Like it's expensive.
Yeah, it does. Tell me about it.
It does.
You know what really kills me? I had to buy a Mac Pro. We bought a Mac Pro for our third editor last week. And, you know, we were trying to wait till the Extreme came out with the 6 processors. And we just gave up waiting for Apple. And guess what? Of course, I'm sure next week they'll announce it.
Well, we thank you for that, Leo.
Yeah, I know they're
waiting.
That's the
trend we like to see, right?
It pisses me off. I mean,
you buy something and then we get the benefits.
But Apple's been so slow getting these Extremes into the Mac Pros, you would think. I mean, they're out, right? The PC makers are using them, right?
The desktop is dead, Leo. It's all about the tablet now.
So there are plenty of PCs with a 6-core.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. 6-core's been out since... October, November, like that.
Used to be Apple would be like the first with a new Intel chip, and they'd be quick out. You're right. You're hitting the nail on the head, Patrick. They don't. They're going to sell more of these little things. These little pad
higher
things.
Margin.
Yeah, probably.
I mean, another component release that happened last week was a new graphics card release, GeForce GTX 465. There's not a whole lot different here, other than it's slightly slower part, slightly lower price, $279. It's it's the lowest priced DirectX 11 capable graphics card from NVIDIA. So that's kind of important. It does put it on kind of a price performance balance with AMD at this point. It performs fairly close to the Radeon 5850, which is priced at the exact same limit. Now these cards are still hotter. They're still going to consume more power than the AMD parts. So there's still disadvantages there. You can only run 2 monitors on them instead of 3, which is a feature that I think a lot of people are deciding is kind of cool to do. But it's important for NVIDIA because they're getting kind of hammered in the media and in the market in terms of having parts that are not as efficient, not nearly as power efficient, not nearly as performance efficient, and I think they're having problems making these parts as well, getting them to as high of clock speeds as they need to, and with good yield. So creating a part like the 465 allows them to sell more of those chips that perhaps would not have otherwise been able to have been sold. They would have been tossed out or melted down or whatever they do with bad processor dies.
Ryan has created a new metric, which is bangs, dollars per CUDA core.
And oh, right. Yes.
So the 480 is $1.03 per CUDA core. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The 470 is 77 cents per CUDA core. What is the 465? What is the cost per CUDA core?
It's about the same, like 79 cents or something like that. And CUDA cores, I should say, are the is what NVIDIA calls the shader units inside their
CUDA.
GPU, right. And so the more of those you have, the faster your GPU is going to go, the faster your gaming is going to go, the faster whatever GPU-based applications you have are going to go.
I mean, there's a lot. I mean, the 470 has 448 cores. That's a lot.
Yeah, the 480 has 480. That's actually amazing. But if you look at it's a dance that the AMD and NVIDIA go through, because if you look at the current high-end part that AMD has, it's 1,600 stream processors in a single GPU. But it's all, but those, I mean, they're not directly comparable to each other. They perform different, numbers of math operations per second and things like that. So it's not, you really can't compare them across platform, but
it's not merely that it has more cores or more multiprocessors. It's other things.
There's lots of stuff that goes into it. It's only really useful for comparing cards that are in the same family, right? So it's interesting. You look at the GTX 470 to the GTX 465. It has 25% fewer shader processors, 25% smaller memory bus, and the performance is about 25% less.
Is there one number? I mean, that you could say this is a way of comparing apples to oranges.
Between what, NVIDIA and AMD?
Well, any of them. Is it gigatexels per second? Or
No, none of that. None of that really matters. And that's why we have to spend so much time doing actual real-world game
rate.
Testing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because at the end of the day, there's a big software component to it as well.
Right.
So it's whichever team, NVIDIA or AMD, is making the best drivers for whatever games you're playing, that comes into just as much the story as the hardware itself. So GTX 465's out. It's a good card if you're looking for a DX11 part, $279. Check it out.
More news from Computex coming up, plus PC Magazine has rated the fastest mobile networks in the country. What do you have? A fast one or a slow one? We'll talk about that in just a second. Ryan Shrout is on the line from Taipei, where he is at Computex 2010. Patrick Norton is on the line from his kitchen. And I'm Leo Laporte. We'll be right back. But I want to tell you a little bit about Carbonite Pro. Carbonite, the great backup service we talk about all the time on the network, on the radio show, too. It's such a cool service. It allows you to back up automatically all your precious files for one low flat fee, less than $5 a month, to the cloud where it's secure, it's safe, and can be retrieved at any time by any computer that can get online. Well, it turned out so many people liked Carbonite, the consumer version, they started to use it in business. Because there really isn't a great affordable solution for business. So Carbonite said, maybe we got to do something about that. And they created Carbonite Pro. CarbonitePro.com. It's the same idea. You install Carbonite Pro on your desktops, all your users, as many users as you want. You have a central dashboard that keeps track of who's backed up, who's not. Your individual users can restore if you let them, which is a nice feature. I always hated, Patrick, that walk down the hall at Tech TV. Can you restore my hard drive? I deleted something important. Now your employees can do that themselves. Carbonite Pro, you could try it free for 30 days right now. Go to carbonitepro.com. That's all you have to do. They're really good about on this. They send you emails. They say, are you using it? Here's how it works. And they set it all up. Price is very affordable. It starts as low as $10 per month for your business. I'll give you some examples. 8 computers, 5 gigs, $25 a month. 18 computers, 5 gigs, $50 a month. Very affordable and frankly, a lot less expensive than buying Carbonite, the consumer version for each user. Plus all the, nice centralized features make it very simple. Good for business. CarbonitePro.com. Give it a try.
We take you back to Taiwan, where Ryan Shrout is having breakfast.
I did. It was a good breakfast, actually.
What'd you have?
I had an omelet and some salmon, cream cheese, onions. It was very good.
So we were talking about bandwidth in Taiwan versus bandwidth in Japan. PC Magazine has decided to, I think this is a really good, only PC Magazine can do this stuff. This is where ZD and PC really excel, I think. Because you need a big magazine to do these kinds of tests.
You need lots of people in various locations across the country.
Yeah. So Did they say, is there a clear-cut winner? Is there like one network that's the best?
Well, Patrick, you were the one that pointed us to the article here. I was looking through it.
I guess it depends where you are. I mean, national AT&T is the best.
Right. But they did like Northeast, Southeast, Central. It looks to me that AT&T is more consistently ahead of everybody else, which I think is something that we had heard and talked about.
This surprises me, though.
That they have the fastest network, but having the fastest,
they claim that
you have the best.
They claim that. Right. And PC Magazine's rating them for consistency, download speed, upload speed, time to first byte, all of which are, you know, very. And then this was weird, Patrick. I always thought Verizon was the best in New York City. Did you see T-Mobile has the best 3G? They have HSPA Plus in New York City. Patrick, are you there? Oh, he's muted.
I had the mute on. I kept trying to say something. You guys kept ignoring me.
We're ignoring you, Patrick.
Just like the old days, isn't it?
Well, here's the thing, right? Sasha Sagan does all the mobile testing for PC Mag. He knows more about mobile phones and mobile phone networks than anybody I've ever seen. And one of the interesting things about the mobile networks is depending on when a particular organization got into the market, it really dictated the quality of their cell sites and the quality of the bandwidth they had. So what you're looking at right there, they looked at 6 networks. They did 1,000 rounds of tests in 20 cities, pretty much from like Boise to Miami, New York to San Francisco. And like you guys were saying, AT&T consistently had the fastest network. They did not consistently have the most consistent network to use kind of an
I see what you mean. Structure.
So, you know, yeah, in one of my English majory pain moments there. So what they did is they broke down it by city, by region of the country, and it's a pretty good list of networks: AT&T, Cricket, T-Mobile, Verizon Wireless, Sprint 3G, and Sprint 4G. And they basically had people go to different areas in each city to run multiple rounds of tests. And AT&T was the fastest, but the most consistent, I want to say, looks like it might have been Sprint. I could be wrong. I haven't analyzed all the numbers, but you know, if you look at like national, PC Mag, the mobile speed index, AT&T was 93, the consistency was 86, Sprint 3G was like, you know, their speed index was 76, but their average around the country was like 95.9. And the metrics they put together are basically looking at the download speed, the upload speed, and how consistent they were across different locations around the United States. And AT&T and Verizon really have an advantage in this in terms of their networks and having some of the best bandwidth. AT&T, of course, owning the bandwidth, but hasn't rolled it out in all of their markets yet.
Doesn't this surprise you? Because it seems so contrary to our own experience.
Well,
that's what gets me. I mean, if you ask anybody who's the fastest, most consistent network, they're going to say Verizon no matter where.
Part of Verizon
comes out low in every one of these tests. They're one of the worst.
See, if you ask me, I'd say Sprint, because I've owned Sprint. Mm-hmm.
You've always liked Sprint, I know. Yeah.
Sprint's performance has been great, and it's always been very consistent for me no matter what hotel, city, side of the road, highway I was. I just upgraded to Sprint Overdrive, even though 4G is not available in San Francisco yet, because it – A, would allow me to connect my iPad to the internet without having to wait for an iPad 3G and pay another $30 a month to AT&T, and B, brings GPS, a GPS sensor to the non-GPS 3G iPad. But what's interesting about the device is it basically supports 3G. It also supports 4G. What PC Mag is looking at here is primarily data access. So they weren't looking at call drops. They weren't looking at sort of call quality. They're purely looking at data and data access speeds. You know, Sprint's kind of interesting because they're doing WiMAX right now. Essentially, their 4G is WiMAX, not the 3G technology. But
it's not WiMAX in every market. Somebody told me, even though we were using 4G in Las Vegas, it wasn't WiMAX.
Well, it depends on on which 4G. 4G.
I was using Sprint 4G Clear in Las Vegas, and somebody said it's not WiMAX in Las Vegas.
Well, but
is that
4G,
wrong?
4G is not a spec. Okay. 4G is not a technology. 4G has become the blanket term
for next
everything
generation.
That is supposed to be faster than 3G.
Right.
So there's a half dozen different technologies that kind of fall into the 4G blanket.
Yeah, there's LTE and there's Clear Wires using WiMAX.
WiMAX. Yeah. You know. Clearwire, which like is basically owned by Sprint.
Do you know, I just found out that Craig McCaw, is Clearwire. Here's a guy, really, we should lionize. I mean, he created cell networks in the U.S. He was one of the first guys, Cellular One and all that. And he has just gone on. And now he's doing Clearwire. He's kind of an amazing guy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I thought what was interesting about this is that the Sprint 4G network wasn't that much faster in a lot of cases than, say, the AT&T
network. That was our experience. I'm sure Colleen has mentioned that, but in Vegas it was not.
Now, the maximums were higher. And what's interesting in this is I was doing some tests on I have the iPad 3G, and I was doing some of the AT&T tests, and I got some tests that were, like 3.5 megabits per second that, are a little bit higher than some of the maxes they saw here. And I was getting very reliable speed. Maybe it's because, in the Cincinnati area, it's not exactly a technology.
How do we account for the fact that the reputation of AT&T is so bad? Is it because of their phone?
iPhone. It's got to be their drop calls. That's my life.
Well, that's part of it. But I think the iPhone also may not give you the best performance.
I wouldn't be surprised. Every major carrier, whether we're talking or ISP, every ISP, whether you're talking about DSL, cable modem, wireless, Wi-Fi, basically everybody has packet shaping in place on their network, right? Especially the cable companies and certainly the wireless companies. I wouldn't be surprised if the 3G that goes to the iPhone was heavily packet shaped.
Maybe.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Maybe.
There's also a question of density. In terms of like population density, the number of phones accessing a particular tower at a time, it's amazing to realize how crazy all of this gets, how quickly, and also the general consensus that AT&T has not kept up particularly well with 3G demand. I wouldn't be surprised if maybe they kept a little bandwidth to the side for their data subscribers that are actually using a device to connect to their PC or MacBook, that they maybe give the 3G phones access to.
What testing methodology was used in this?
They have developed their own testing methodology and software, and I am not particularly familiar with that.
So it wasn't with a phone.
No, they were using devices that attached to computers. I'm trying to find the exact. Hold on. Let me pull up the Howie Tester article.
It's sufficient. Yeah, we're running out of time. It's sufficient to know that it wasn't a phone or any particular phone.
Yeah.
Right.
So if there is a difference between one handset and another, it wouldn't be reflected in these numbers.
No, they use the same two notebooks with basically the modems that are sold by individual carriers.
Okay.
And they basically shipped the same notebooks all around the country to the different testers since they were using the exact same hardware.
It's not hardware, but do you feel betrayed by AT&T changing it to its tiered pricing? I guess this was inevitable.
It's funny. Dylan Tweeney over at Wired.com I hadn't read it before. He did an amazing article earlier this year when a lot of the net neutrality foo-rah was going around. And he's basically saying, look, net neutrality is a great concept, but here's all of the negative impacts it's going to have on broadband and wireless broadband in the United States. And I think he was probably spot on. The general consensus I've seen from a lot of industry observers is that it was inevitable, given the demand with smartphones, that there would be some kind of per byte charge coming on wireless devices. If you look at Cisco, just did their annual, the state of the video moving on to the internet report that they've done for the last few years. And they're talking about in 4 years, something like quadruple the video traffic. But like video traffic is already the 90% of the, in 4 years, 90% of the traffic on the internet is going to be video traffic. 90% of all traffic on the internet on an average day.
By bit.
By in terms of
because bit, it's so heavy, yeah.
Because it's so heavy, because the files are so big, because we're all going HD. Certainly the ISPs and AT&T, they're a for-profit company. They've demonstrated that again and again. These are the people who are arguing that no. See, we can't give you the bandwidth you think you're paying for every second of the day, 24 hours a day. We'll give you it in bursts. You know, right. You can download a web page. It's 15 kilobits, but a 4 gigabyte file? No. You know, and they're, you know, they had their you know, technical economists do this amazing white paper justifying how if we actually gave you the bandwidth you think you're paying for every second of the day, every day of the year, it would cost you $475 a month to get a commercial account that would deliver that bandwidth to your home. Right?
You'll have to forgive me because these are the same companies who charge $1,500 a megabyte for SMS messages.
Yeah, no,
so
kidding.
They've kind of lost any credibility with me. This may be true and it may not be true.
I'm firmly on your side on this one, but the, you know, the reality is I think, you know, the FCC has done some interesting studies. You can take I would take anything coming from AT&T or Comcast.
Right. Here's the opportunity.
Block.
Here's the opportunity. There are two companies who are kind of also rans at this point. You got Verizon and AT&T duking it out at the top. Sprint with his Evo, I think, is going to start doing well. But they're kind of an also ran, and T-Mobile's really kind of down at the bottom. Mm-hmm. If T-Mobile doesn't tier, if one of them doesn't tier, they have a real opportunity to grab market share, right? If they can figure out a way to do it,
I would say yes.
Because isn't everybody going to tier?
I think everybody's going to tier. But what happened is Sprint held out as with uncapped wireless modems for longer than anybody else did.
Right.
That's one of the they had great speed. They had an awesome network coverage, and they also had no cap on wireless data plans. So that is the third reason I went with Sprint. Finally, right. I want to say at the end of 98 or end of 98, end of 2008, I think that was when they put the same 5 gigabyte cap on that everybody else does. And I'm not sure why I'm talking with my hands today. I'm not sure what that's about. But part of the reason they did that, you know, or one of the theories around why they did that is because they didn't have a cap. Everybody who was getting beat on for blowing through the cap on the other networks came to their
network. They got all the hogs. That's what they got. I get it.
You know, and every time you read one of these, every time you read anything from any of the providers, whether it's Comcast for cable modem or one of the wireless providers like AT&T, they always say it's 2% of our subscribers that actually use more than this cap. And what they don't say is that 2% is the leading edge, right? Because 250 gigabytes sounds like a huge amount of data. Right. I've got 250 gigabytes. Gigabytes I can download every month until you realize that a mediocre quality HD movie off of iTunes is typically 4 gigabytes.
My 80-year-old father-in-law, who I gave an iPad to a week ago, sent me an email 5 days later, said I went through all 250 megabytes. I guess I'm going to have to get the unlimited. So it's not just bleeding edge. But you're right. Any company that dares to not tier, to have either unlimited or to not do this tiering that AT&T has launched, is going to get all the bandwidth hogs and is going to put themselves out of business.
The 250 megabyte cap is, especially on the iPad, is a complete MacGuffin. It's a joke.
It's unusable.
And because a lot of people don't realize, I don't know if it was Engadget or Gizmodo, one of the websites basically traced the exact amount of data that doing a Facebook page, like checking your Facebook page three times or checking four Twitter accounts.
Wow.
A Facebook page was like a megabyte and a half or 4 megabytes.
Well, that explains it because he wrote me, he said, how could I have gone through 250 megabytes? And I said, I don't know what you've been doing.
Well, but literally it turned out it was like,
Facebook.
I think it was... Yeah, checking Facebook four times is 7 megabytes or some insane number like that because it recaches everything.
That's
on the page,
no caching on it. Yeah.
I stopped doing the speed test because the speed test I was using on the iPad did 10 megabytes each time.
Yeah.
I thought, well, I'm not going to be able to do very many of those. Hey, we got a lot of news, and I have another ad. And Patrick, you've got to go do forecast. Ryan, why don't we run through some of the headlines from Computex right now, some of the stories.
So I think obviously we need to touch on the world of Slate and Pad, ePads, whatever you want to call them. So tons of these were announced. Asus was probably the most prominent one here, probably because they're one of the largest Taiwanese technology companies. They announced two different models. I can't remember the model numbers, but a 12-inch tablet. The 10-inch tablet uses the NVIDIA Tegra 2 chip. It uses a Windows 7 CE embedded operating system. And so then you have their own kind of Asus branded and built kind of software layer on top of things, which I have to say, you know, I got some hands-on time with it, and it wasn't that great yet. Right?
A company like Asus cannot compete with a company like Apple at this level.
When it comes to software, and that's what I was trying to...
I was going
to
say, is it a software issue, or is it a... Because the Tegra seems like a pretty solid...
Oh, the hardware's there. The hardware's there.
The hardware's fine. It's just... You got a software, a very, very small company attempting to
right.
do the same.
Although
kind of
HTC's Sense is a really nice UI on top of Android, yeah. I have to say. So that's possible.
There's hope there. And these parts aren't going to be out until Q1 of next year. So they've got another 6 months to work on the software side of things. But you're right. I think the Tegra 2 platform provides enough power for, you know, to compete with what the iPad does and that kind of stuff. And then the 12-inch model.
Microsoft, Microsoft was running around with a Windows embedded Compaq 7. And that actually, from the couple shots I thought, it looked like a huge. I keep thinking like Windows CE. I was like, oh, it's not dead yet. That's so sweet. But you know, but an optimized version of Windows 7, because they have some decent multi-touch inside of Windows 7. That actually could be useful if they had.
It's called Microsoft Windows Embedded Compaq 7. Another one of their great names for an operating system. But is it kind of like a Zune based operating system, like a mix of Zune and Kin operating systems, I guess.
But Zune's good.
From what I read, it's not. They're not planning on actually producing this, right? It was just kind of a proof of concept for the software, I guess. But
what about Android? I mean, look, you gotta have a multi-touch mobile operating system. Android's pretty polished.
Yep.
Aren't people doing? I mean, there must have been a lot of Android tablets there.
There were Android tablets there, but they weren't nearly as prominent. Like all the ones that we saw were either using Windows 7 or Windows 7, you know, like Windows CE.
Is embedded? Embedded? How is embedded different from the 7? Is it?
Embedded is not an x86 operating system, so it's not. It can't run traditional Windows applications. It's built for that hardware. Since Tegra is an ARM-based processor with, you know, some NVIDIA GPU bits and that kind of stuff thrown in, it could not use your standard kind of Windows 7 or Windows 7 mobile iteration.
And embedded is, I'm told, modular. Paul Thurrott said it's modular, so they can plug in stuff, which gives them the capability of running on lighter or harder, bigger hardware, depending on what they've got.
Right. The 12-inch tablet that they were showing, obviously bigger, nice. But it uses Intel CULV, Core 2 CULV parts, and was running Windows 7 on it. So that one was kind of like, it had much, much faster hardware. They were still claiming to be able to get 10, 12 hours battery life out of it using, you know, the lowest voltage possible for a Core 2 processor.
Haven't we been there, done that, and
I kind of feel that way, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, at least 7 has multi-touch and, you know, more touch built in, but we've seen Windows tablets, and they haven't really...
They haven't impressed.
Oh, we've seen an Apple tablet, too. It was just a long time ago.
Yeah, the Newton. Yeah, they've come a long way since then.
So, but the interesting thing to me was the hardware itself seemed very nice, very polished. It was very, you know, not quite up to Apple build qualities yet. But again, we're still 6 months out from most of these hitting the street. And they had connectivity. You know, they had headphone jacks and audio jacks, input jacks. They had USB ports, things like that maybe we have to admit could be useful on a tablet, even if you don't have to use them all the time. So, you know, they're still, I think you're right. Like the previous tablets were, it was just Windows on a tablet with a touchscreen and it didn't really work out that well. I think they're trying harder to go towards what the iPad has done in terms of software and in terms of simplicity of hardware. But I feel like nobody wants to make that jump completely. Like everybody's afraid to, in this industry, to release a tablet without a USB port or release a tablet without, kind of Windows base behind it or things like that, you know, even though we saw some of the Android models out there. So
I'm really interested. I mean, I love Android. I've abandoned my iPhone for Android. I'm really interested to see if an Android tablet can compete with the iPad.
See, I haven't had an Android phone yet. So this HTC Evo 4G will be my first.
I think you're going to like it. I really do.
I like my Palm Pre
and
the operating system on that. And I know the whole HP Palm stuff we've talked about before and the possibilities there are pretty good.
They didn't show anything there.
Mm-mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's too early.
Yeah.
Well, is it? Because wasn't the Slate going to come out this year? I thought it was.
I mean, I think it's too early for the Palm.
Oh, WebOS to be integrated. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd love to see that. WebOS would be a great choice as well. I'd be very happy to see WebOS on a tablet. It's my opinion that it's got to be a mobile operating system with multi-touch and designed around the idea that you're touching stuff as opposed to, clicking stuff.
Emulating a mouse.
Right. Yeah. And that's what Windows 7 is going to do, essentially, is emulate a mouse. I don't.
The other major topic from Computex I figured I'd mention real quick is AMD showed their first Fusion APU. This is an APU stands for Accelerated Processing Unit. It's a term AMD basically invented for the processor that's finally going to be the result of the AMD-ATI merger. So these Fusion parts are traditional x86 processing architecture cores included on the same die, designed for the same chip as GPU stream processors. This is traditional what you see in a GPU. So they're basically combining the power of the CPU and GPU and putting it in one part. They're going to share a memory bus. They're going to share a whole lot of different components. And they demonstrated it for the first time. And they're way behind on what they should be, where they should be in terms of this design and the hardware for this. But it was fairly impressive. They didn't give any specifics. They showed the Ontario version, which is going to be for aiming at like the Atom markets, netbooks, low-end notebooks, that type of thing. Running a DirectX 11 game, they didn't say at what resolution, but it looked pretty good. It was relatively smooth on pretty early hardware. They have a full-size notebook version that's going to include four x86 processing cores plus probably like a Redwood style. Think of Radeon performance around like a 5500 or a 5600 graphics card all in one chip. And so this is obviously, it's a big deal for the industry. It's a big deal for these OEMs and ODMs. And I think it's gonna change the market that Patrick and I love so much, the DIY market, quite a bit, because essentially what AMD is hoping to do is take any graphics card that you can buy for under $100 and make it irrelevant, because you could buy a CPU with that much power integrated into the die.
That would be nice.
Yeah, it would be. It would be. But now you got to be worried about whether or not that's going to completely kill the discrete graphics market, or if it will drastically lower its, how much work they're willing to do for this small enthusiast base to get graphics cards up and running and that kind of stuff. When they would much rather sell these integrated parts that are going to be higher margin, lower cost, better for the OEMs to integrate into their systems and that kind of stuff. But it's interesting from a technology perspective.
I mean, I think I agree that it's interesting from a technology perspective, but you know, the performance and the heat for decent 3D gaming at this point, I think is going to preclude the enthusiast market kind of getting walked away from at the high end, or at least at the decent gaming level, like $200 and up. And also, Intel can't seem to build a decent graphics card, unless Larry.
Haven't they kind of given up on that? The discrete graphics.
They actually showed of their next generation part called Sandy Bridge, and that integrates CPU and GPU as well. But you're right, Intel doesn't have nearly the reputation for hot, solid graphics in that market. But they've kind of canceled the Larrabee project when it comes to like going to the world of discrete graphics, it would seem. And we saw another brief demonstration of Sandy Bridge graphics performance, and it was again fairly good. I would compare the performances we saw on the first Fusion APU to what Intel's Sandy Bridge showed. But the difference is the Fusion APU is like a netbook part, and the Sandy Bridge part is like a full-size desktop part. So there's still going to be some dramatic differences there. But I think Intel is, over the last 3 to 4 years, they have understood what is going to happen, that they need to focus as much on their traditional GPU stream, just highly stream capable computing, as opposed to just the standard processors as well. That leaves NVIDIA kind of out on its own right now.
And so what if Intel buys NVIDIA?
Then it would be great.
We've lost Leo.
No, I don't think that's going to happen. I think that the window of opportunity for that went.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that offer was probably made 5 or 6 years ago. And from what I've heard, rumors around Taiwan and that kind of stuff is that the cultures of the two companies just clash so much that they wouldn't be able to do it. And you think about it, NVIDIA is a very marketing-driven kind of, pound the fist on the table type company, whereas Intel does all that behind the scenes, right? They go out and plot your demise behind your back. Whereas
NVIDIA likes some friends who work at Intel. They always said there was a lot of screaming and pounding on tables.
Yeah. So, it's just an interesting technological shift because you're going to be able to buy these parts for, $300, $400, probably less than that. And get CPU, GPU all in one, and it's going to be, you know, think of what you can get today from a Radeon 5600 card or a 5500 card, and you're going to get that performance, in theory, from one of these parts. So it should be interesting. Yeah.
We have questions. You have answers. We're going to get to those in just a second. You're listening to This Week in Computer Hardware. Ryan Shroud is in Taipei, Taiwan, covering Computex 2010. Patrick Norton from TechZilla.com is also here. But first, oh, hey, Patrick Norton! TechZilla.com! He's so cute. But first, I want to talk about Audible.com. Since I'm here, can I do the ad? Because, I mean, golly, I'm the Audible guy here. Audiblepodcast.com/Twitch. You can go there right now. Your first book is free, and there's so many great choices. But look at this. Look at this. This is my Nexus One running the new Audible beta software. I'm so excited. Finally, our Audible books, you can listen to them on your Android phones. Now, this is beta. You have to go to Google Groups, groups.google.com, and look for the Audible Android beta. But you see, that's all the books in my library. I can download any one of them, listen to them. Oh, oh, the screen went off. I have to, yeah, there you go. And you can it does all sorts of weird Foursquare like badges for the most books listened to and stuff like that. They made it a game. This is something even the iPhone doesn't have right now. The iPhone, you just sync up with iTunes and it just plays like an iTunes thing. But this is a dedicated Android. I think we've confused John. Give it to me. Give it to me. You never used Android, did you? This is a dedicated. App, which is kind of cool. I don't think you can yet buy books on here, but it sure is nice. So now I can safely say Audible plays on almost everything, including Android phones. Of course, all the Apple devices, the Zune, the Kindle. And man, I tell you, if you are taking a long flight across the Pacific or just a drive to work in the morning, having a great audiobook or two. Did you listen to audiobooks at all, Ryan, on your trip?
I did. So it's a 14.5-hour flight from L.A., to Taipei, and it's about 12 and a half hours going back. Ugh. So, yes.
You got to have audiobooks.
Yeah.
What did you listen to? What do you like?
I'm a Star Wars nerd, so I was listening to the latest Star Wars novel that had come out.
That's supposed to be pretty good. Was it good?
Yeah, you know, some of the first ones that came out were really, really, really good. They've kind of gotten a little stale recently, like they're trying to think of ideas for stories and that kind of thing still. Yeah. But it's a continuation of the universe that Star Wars took place in. So all the characters in there are grown up and have kids and have grandkids and all this other kind of stuff. It's kind of weird, but it's one of those books. One comes out every 2 or 3 months and I'm like, all right, I'll read that.
So. Spoiler alert. Luke is Darth Vader's son. No, just kidding. So before your next long journey, I want you to go to audiblepodcast.com/Twitch and get a book free. There's so many great choices there. You will love how they are read, too. They're not dry. They come alive on your iPhone or your Android phone. Just fantastic. Audiblepodcast.com/Twitch. Patrick, when you get your Evo, I want you to put your Audible software on there. You're going to love it. We've got questions. Ryan and Patrick, do you have answers?
Try.
Maybe.
Tweet to Ryan Shroud on Twitter. It's at RyanShroud. That's what Zezix did. He said, yeah, hey, Ryan, buying a Vertex 2 120 gigabyte running Win 7, what tweaks are absolutely necessary and what tweaks are just recommended?
So my answer to this is none. Yeah. The Windows 7 implements trim. Vertex 2 drive supports trim. There are a lot of places and a lot of forums you can go to that will tell you, well, if you partition the drive with a certain offset, it will improve performance and all this other kind of stuff. And in truth, if those even change anything, the differences are minute.
Trim's the only thing that matters.
Trim is the only thing that really matters. And now that we've got that implemented, Windows 7 is out.
What do you mean, white man? We Mac users don't. We Linux users don't. It's just Windows 7.
Hmm. Well, that's what you get for...
That's what I get.
Steve Jobs is a...
That's what I get.
The big camera shot full of nothing is what you get. But yeah, I mean...
Yeah.
Hey, you know what? I'm a big Ubuntu Lucid Lynx fan. I love 10.04. It's just fantastic. And I have it in a machine, my Samsung NC20 that has an SSD in it. But of course, as Alan told me, there's no really get no benefit from the SSD in there anyway because it's not a SATA 2 bus. But I feel, it makes me feel bad that there's no trim.
You still
support.
Get benefits of the quick access times.
Absolutely.
You just don't get extended bandwidth.
Zero seek. I mean, yeah. And there's no, you know, the reason I put it in is because the NC20, which is a little netbook, you could feel this hard drive spinning. You could feel the momentum from the hard drive. And it just was weird holding a laptop that had its own centripetal force, you know?
It's like it's a pretty old school sensation. I mean, I'm actually running an SSD in my work notebook right now under OS 10 quite happily. You know, I also haven't filled it up to the point where it's starting to sort of back up and choke on things, at which point, you know, there's you know, either, you know, wipe it and reinstall your
will that do the same as trim?
I mean, so what you can do is if, like, you back up your, if you image your drive to like an external drive and then image it back, you're reset. Like, because basically it writes all data in one giant pass. What trim fixes is all the random things that get jumbled up and that kind of stuff. But if you just, you read it all out and then you write the whole thing back to it, it should be much improved again.
It's kind of like disk optimization for SSDs.
Yeah.
Basically. Jason BNE tweets, Ryan Schrout, question for Twitch, is extra bucks for Core i7-9XX versus 8XX worth the extra speed or stuff? Thanks.
Stuff. Is it worth the money?
How much more is a 900 series than an 800 series?
It depends on which processor you go for.
Yeah, is it a lot more?
Yeah.
You know, for $1,000 processor?
The most popular one's the 920 that Patrick uses. So. Yeah.
That's not the 6-core.
The difference comes in the platform, though.
Oh. Going because to i7 is the real benefit.
Yeah, so Core i7-900 series uses a different socket than the Core i7-800 series. The 800 series is Linfield part. The 900 series is the Bloomfield part. Bloomfield is the original Nehalem part that came out, triple-channel memory, 1366 LGA socket. So it's bigger. Usually those motherboards have more PCI Express lanes on the board and that kind of stuff. And then the 800 series, it's Linfield. It's dual channel memory. It's a little bit different core. The chipset's a little bit lower end. So, I mean,
besides having to add RAM and 3 sticks versus 2 sticks, is there really a speed benefit to triple channel?
I mean, there are performance benefits to triple channel. Yeah. I mean, they're not dramatic. I would say somewhere in the order of 5% or something like that. You get a lot of people say that Patrick is one of those guys that loves the Core i7-920 processor. Right. So, I mean, it's known to be very overclockable. I know Colleen loves those. I think it's relatively cheap now, $200 or something like that.
I'm actually checking on Newegg right now to see what the updated prices are on that. Sorry, give me 1 second and I'll sort that out.
I have an I bought an i7 Mac laptop. But is that silly?
So it's i7, but it's still, you know, the dual core Linfield architecture or Clarkdale Linfield architecture.
It's part too, right?
I guess to answer his question, I would say probably not to me. Like, I would use I built a Core i7-860 part, right? So
we talked about this on the radio show. There's not that much difference in i5 and i7 except hyper-threading, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
By the way, Patrick, an answer from our chat room. There is a Android navigation program called Copilot Live that does funny.
Copilot Live is a very funny application. It's available on the iPhone OS too.
Yeah, it's $30,
which is cheap for a dedicated
navigation
application.
And it stores the maps on the phone.
Good to know. Oh, the Core i7 860 Linfield and the Core i7-920 are both selling for $280 now on Newegg.
Hmm.
So
okay.
It's a wash. So you'll spend a little bit more on you might spend a little bit more on memory and the motherboard going with the Bloomfield, the 920 part. But I mean, especially chances are if you're upgrading from anything that's more than a couple of years old, the performance boost is going to be so ridiculous. Much like going from any rotating hard drive at this point to an SSD, the performance boost is going to be so ridiculous. You're not really going to, you know, miss that extra 5%, I would imagine.
Yeah. Mussinger tweets, Recommendation for a video card that drives three monitors, preferably DVI or HDMI, less than $150, and quiet performance. Who cares?
I did a real quick check. You can get the Radeon 5670 graphics card for under $90 now. I think, wow, I saw some for around $80. Those support three displays, and the Radeon 5000 series are the only cards out right now, kind of consumer cards, that will run three displays.
What does it have? Two DVIs and mini display port, or how does it?
It has two DVIs and a display port.
Display port. Okay.
And you have to have, or the like one of the XFXs I'm looking at has a DVI and HDMI and a display port.
Hmm.
But the caveat is one of them has to be display port if you want to do three displays out of it. So that means you'll have to get, if you're just the one 1080p resolution, you can just get a passive adapter to go from display port to HDMI or DVI or whatever it is you need. If you're doing larger screen, like 2560 by 1600, if you're doing 30-inch monitors or something like that, you have to get a much more expensive active adapter that will usually run you about $100, requires power and that kind of stuff, which is a little bit of a pain. Actually, it's a lot of a pain. But the passive adapters work pretty well. So you can get three monitors for way under $150. Just look for anything in the 5000 series and check out the connectivity options there. And as long as it has one display port connection, you'll be able to do three displays.
Cool.
Yep.
Next question from Daniel E. West. He tweets, do you think the onslaught of DLC for PC games will just nickel and dime PC gamers and hurt the industry or make it flourish? Uh-oh. What's DLC?
Downloadable content.
Oh.
Yeah.
They're talking about Steam. No? They're talking about in-game downloadable content. They're talking about Modern Warfare 2, the new maps. What are they talking about?
They're talking about that kind of stuff, exactly, is the idea of paying $5 for new maps for Halo, right, or buying new missions in Mass Effect.
That's 2, good. That's good for business. It's good for gamers. Paul Thurrott's a perfect example, like a lot of Modern Warfare 2 guys. He got to 10th level prestige. He stopped playing until the new maps came out today. He's happy.
I'm not a fan of it. Like, I don't like the idea. I do feel like I'm being nickel and dimed all the time.
But it's more content. It's more play, right?
A lot of people like to complain that, well, this is content that was in the game that they took out so they could charge you again for it later. And, you know, a lot of conspiracy theory and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. There's also a lot of people who basically spent 2 years playing a single Halo map or four or five Halo maps in brutal onslaught mode. So
I'm still playing Quake 2. I don't know what they're talking about.
Well, you know what I mean? But it's like the whole idea that, like, you know, I have to be online to deal with insert name of annoying company's security process.
Well, I think Ubisoft's done more to hurt PC gaming than anybody.
Yeah, no doubt.
And I also think that's all
this question. It doesn't matter what we think about it, because that's the way it's going, and that's the way it's going to keep going.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of DLC and the micro transactions is what they like to call it, right? It's only $1, right? But it's only $1.50 times a year, so that's how they get it.
It's less than the game was originally, probably, right?
Yeah.
I agree, though, if they stripped down these games so that they, you know, you could only get 10 hours of gameplay unless you bought the additional DLC, I could see that would be unhappy. But that's, doesn't feel that way yet.
No, I mean, it also depends on the
game, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm the kind of idiot that buys stuff on Steam every week, so.
Have you paid for anything for your farm yet?
Yeah.
That's the same idea.
Yeah. Right? So. I don't like that at all. But they took the magic cauliflower away, and they're so sneaky. They're so sneaky. They got me hooked on the idea that I could level up fast and I could build and build. Then they took away the magic cauliflower, and I had to buy some mojo, but that's a story for another day. Ryan Shroud, when are you coming home?
I leave tonight, and then I begin my 24-hour journey home. So I'll be back for the weekend.
I hope you have some good Audible books to listen to.
Yes, exactly.
And Patrick Norton is seen on Tekzilla, TEKZILLA.com, and yes, Revision please. 3. And anything else you wants to plug, Patrick?
HD Nation, the show I do with Robert Heron every week on high-definition content and home theater equipment.
Love that stuff.
HDNation.tv.
You loving 3D, Patrick?
Not so much.
Not me neither.
I think the killer application for 3D on HDTV is sports. I know some people who have seen football games and freaked over what an amazing experience that was. And gaming, I think, has a lot of potential for 3D. Movies,
right.
I'm not really feeling it, but maybe I'm too old school.
Well, just watch HD Nation. You will find out. You will learn all. And if you guys don't mind, I'd like to come back once in a while because it's kind of fun doing this show, and I learn a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. We like having you there.
And it's your network,
like
dude.
You said, this could be your vacation show, right? You don't have to run the board.
I don't.
Sit I let Jammer.
I can manage my farm while you guys are talking. I just somebody said cauliflower's back. I'm looking to see.
That's what had you distracted when we were talking about that.
I was listening. NVIDIA and ATI and all that stuff.
There were some computers and stuff in there, right? Yeah.
Stuff I was interested in. No,
all right.
That was a lie. There's no Wait a minute. Magic Cauliflower is back. Hoorah!
That may be the name of the show, Magic Cauliflower.
I'm buying some mojo.
The Magic Cauliflower is back. Gotta be it.
It's back, baby. Hey, thank you, Ryan. Hey, thank you, Patrick. We will see you soon. We'll see you next week. We do this show actually live. They do this show. They do this show live every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. Wait a minute. 6 plus 12 is 18 plus 7 is 0100 UTC the following day. How about that? In your head calculations. See you next time on This Week in Computer Hardware.